Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff McClure.
That is our 1950s radio voices, because we can. We do that so that you know that we're exciting, because we tell you so. Even
right.
Though we're economists, we're bald and bearded, and generally speaking, children will run screaming from the room at the sound of our voices. That is exciting in itself, I suppose.
Well, that is not actually true.
My own children will say, Mama, can we listen to the radio? And she'll turn it on, and it'll go for about 10 seconds, and they say, okay, that's enough, turn it off.
Well, your children are relatively young, and they have short attention spans. My children... One of my children listens to this entire program every week.
We didn't actually say the age of the children, did we? Because technically,
no.
I am your child, even though I'm an adult.
You are. Exactly.
So,
and you listen, to the best of my understanding, every week without fail, you listen to the entire program.
I'm not really paying attention, though. That's the whole thing. That's why.
I got it.
What did you just say? I wasn't paying attention. This is Jake and Jeff, and we're here to talk about economics and whether or not children enjoy it.
Right. He's not actually Jeff. I'm Jeff.
Correct. You are correct in that we do not have any form of reversed identities today.
Right. And we are also the principals at a SEC registered investment advisory firm. Not that the SEC approves or disapproves of anything we're doing, but it's just where we're registered.
And not that the advisory firm gives advice on the air, because we can't,
right,
for lots of
but
reasons.
But the name of the investment advisory firm that is registered with the SEC, United States Securities and Exchange Commission, is the Personal Wealth Coach. And it also happens to be the name of this radio program. It is not a coincidence, however. Do not confuse the two, because we're going to be giving information, educational information on this radio program. And the educational information we give on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
We do, however, guarantee that anything we don't say is incomplete. There, see that whole blank spot that we had in the air right there? That was an incomplete
right.
Something. Yeah.
Well,
so there's a guarantee on that.
So we make a warranty and guarantee as to the accuracy of the incompleteness of dead air.
Yes. It is 100% accurately incomplete.
And anyone who actually started off listening to the program has now left.
Yes. We have now successfully chased away all the children, and back to those of you that are old fuddy-duddies like us, though not necessarily bald and bearded.
Oh, cool. Well, did we get we don't pay for the radio program.
That's the last one.
We don't pay KTEM, and KTEM doesn't pay us. We do advertise on KTEM, but Senator, there is no quid pro quo, because the advertising we do on KTEM is mainly, well, it is exclusively for the radio program. We do receive a benefit from the radio program in that our clients apparently listen to it because they comment on it.
That we don't know what that says about the sanity of our clients, but they do comment on it. I am saddened in some portion of my being that our clients have nothing better to do than to listen to us talk. But at some point, I have to agree that this is a good thing, because it does indirectly lead to our better financial well-being.
They do our better?
They do our better, yes.
Oh, okay.
I'm getting into the legal jargon here. They do
good.
Our better.
If you would like to join with us, and today is the 3rd of September on a Labor Day weekend, you don't have anything better to do than listen to us. And you have access to an email transmitting device. You're certainly welcome to send us an email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And we will endeavor to do our best to do our duty to God and country, to be square, obey the Scout Law, and address your question, thought, or comment on the air.
Now, you do. I am less inclined to swear the
oath. Be square and obey the Scout Law?
Well, it is not well defined what square means anymore.
Well, yeah, I got
so,
you.
So, I mean, if I were to take an oath to be square, my rectangular nature might get the better of me, and I am not equal on all sides. There's geometrical issues. I'm sorry, Boy Scouts. All right.
Well,
what happened this week in the market?
It was an interesting week. Some weeks the market is sort of boring. Some weeks it's sort of exciting, and some weeks it's just stupid. This was in the latter category. And I've seen this before. When the United States, when the Federal Reserve says, we pumped a bunch of juice into the economy and we're going to pull some of the juice out that we pumped into the economy. That's metaphor, by the way, although it is liquidity and liquidity equates to juices. So it maybe it works. Then we get what were once called taper tantrums. And it boils down to the fact that when the Federal Reserve says, determines that they're going to raise interest rates, or in this particular case, shrink their balance sheet, which is even more weird than most of the things they do. There are traders who bolt for the door and sell, because there's an old saying, don't fight the Fed. However, as in almost everything else in the economy right now, the macro economy, the traditional signals don't mean what they normally mean, because we got a lot of weird stuff going on outside the economy that's affecting what happens inside the economy instead of the economy just being feedback on itself. And that's very complex, and we can talk about that for 3 hours. Anyway, so the market, the stock market, the S&P 500 stock index fell 3.29%. And for those who keep up with numbers, it's 3924.26. It's now down 18%, just over 18% from its high right at the beginning of January. But it's up 7% from its low point in mid-June. It's down about 13.5% from this time last year, but up. And this is the important thing. If you're an investor, you see the entire process, or should see the entire process, one way. If you are a speculator, a trader, who are the people who drive the day-to-day movements of the market, you see it quite differently. And if you're a speculator at heart and don't know it, then you're really concerned about the fact the market is down teens, 13% this year. So, or 18% this year, the stock market, the S&P 500. On the other hand, if you're an investor, the very minimum time horizon, and I mean minimum time horizon an investor should have, is 3 years. And the S&P 500 is up 38.12% over the last 3 years. So for investors, this is no big thing. For speculators, traders, or people who don't understand what's going on in the market, this is a big thing. So that's where it is. Now, we follow another index, and it's the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index. Why mid-cap value? Because mid-cap value is very different from large-cap growth, and large-cap growth companies, the big companies that are priced in the stock market based on what investors or speculators believe is their potential for growth into the future. Value is a completely different thing. Value is people look at a company and say, if I were to buy that company, the whole company, and I somehow do so without affecting the market price as I put the money in, how much would it be worth? Divide that number by the number of shares that are outstanding, and that's what a fair share price should be. And if the price is below that, it's called, at or below that number, it's called a value stock, because people are purchasing it because if they could buy the entire company at that price, it would be a bargain. And smaller companies, mid-cap value, mid-cap, mid-capitalization companies, are very different from large-cap companies. So the mid-cap value index is another measure of what's going on in the stock market. And we like that index because that's an area of the market that we kind of like. So the CRSP U.S. Mid-Cap Value Index closed at 2325.44. It was down 2.83% for the week. It's down 10.47% from its high in January. Notice that the S&P 500 is down 18. The value mid-cap value index is down about 10, but it's up 7% from its bottom in June. And we could go on about that for a while too. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note has a yield, and it is considered the benchmark for other loans and interest rates in the United States. It rose about 5% to 3.2%. And considering that not that long ago it was way less than 1%, that's a big increase. As a matter of fact, it's up for this year. It has doubled the interest rates on the 10-year Treasury. But the 2-year yield, the 2-year U.S. Treasury yield, was at 3.44. Okay, so the 2-year yield is at 3.44%. The 10-year yield is at 3.2%. That's goofy. That's what we call an inverted yield curve. What is an inverted yield curve? When shorter time maturity treasuries are yielding a higher interest rate than longer term maturity treasuries. That's called an inverted yield curve. Things are upside down. But it's an interesting inversion we have, because if you go out to 20 years, the treasury bond out there is now yielding 3.61%. So if you went from the 2 to 20 years and you look at it and you just look at those two, say, oh, good, solid, positive yield curve. But if you go to the 10, oh, it's lower. We have a yield curve with a dip in the middle. Now, what does that mean? I don't know, and neither does anybody else. Frankly, we are in weird times. We are in a situation where all the rules of thumb you hear about the markets and interest rates and things of that ilk are based on what we call a steady state economy. In other words, the economy is feeding back on itself and it is driving itself, and there's no huge external event causing things to be weird. Right now, we had a huge external event, and the whiplash, the echoes, the repercussions of that event are still with us, which is the pandemic that caused the lockdowns in 2020. But the external events continue to flow. China is locking down again because they still are having fits with COVID. We chose to handle it one way. They chose to handle it another way. And so far, I think our way is working a lot better. I've like night and day better. Russia, in case you haven't noticed, invaded Ukraine and really screwed up the price of oil and logistics and everything else. And all of this is going on simultaneously. Europe is probably slipping into, I say probably, it's approaching certainty at this point, slipping into a pretty nasty recession, primarily because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the fact that oil and gas have been cut off to Europe by Russia.
Not just the invasion of Ukraine, but the absolute trade war that's going on between the rest of the world and Russia. It's affecting Europe far more than the rest of the world.
Sure.
Russia is still being hurt more than Europe, but Europe's definitely feeling it. Go ahead. Sorry.
And then China is the second largest economy in the world. I know some people say, well, it's really large. No, it's not.
It's not.
But China is it's the second largest economy in the world, and it is in a world of hurt. And we don't know exactly what's going on in China because they play with the data just like they do coming out of Russia. You can't, official data comes out of China or Russia, you may rest assured it has been falsified. I mean, you can say that with a great deal of confidence. And they're in a world of hurt. And they do a lot of business with the United States. They supply things that we put together to make final products. We buy things from them. They buy things from us. They're a huge trading partner. And so we've got a lot of external things going on in the world. So what happens with all these external things going on is the normal internal signals that say when A happens, then B will follow. Not necessarily true. So we're in, to use a probably overused metaphor, uncharted waters, and we're churning along. The price of oil, this is what's interesting. There is a critical petroleum energy shortage in a big chunk of the world right now because of Russia's issues. The price of oil, West Texas Intermediate crude oil, dropped to $87.06 a barrel. Now, that may not mean anything to you, but prior to Russia's invasion, there was a consensus among the people who forecast oil prices that in this summer, oil would be around $100 a barrel. We're at the end of the summer when prices are normally high for oil. We're going into the Labor Day weekend when prices are normally high for oil and gasoline, and they're coming down. Now, why is that happening? Basically because China is locking down, so they're not using as much oil. Europe is going into recession, so they're not using as much oil. Actually, they can't get the oil to use. And the end result is the price of gasoline in wherever you are has been lower. We are definitely in a global economy, folks. And we're far more in a global economy than we've ever been. So what happens in Europe, what happens in China has a direct impact on what happens in your finances. And this is one of those things that's hard to get our minds wrapped around that. We can't ignore it. We can't walk away from it. We're just in it. And that was the wrap up in the markets.
All right. Yeah. Well, we've got some questions hanging out there from Inquisitor John, our most faithful and loyal questioner. We have a lot to talk about, obviously. We've got it's a very changing world right now. We're in the middle of fluxes of absolute difference from what it used to be across so many different areas. So we have a lot to talk about. But first, we're going to get to our questions. We got two questions from John this week. Thank you, John. I can't thank you enough. You always provide educated questions that are intriguing even to us. So the first question is, the subject in the email is China bank options. And as is tradition, John has taken a digital picture with his phone of the paper version of the Wall Street Journal to take it from analog to digital, just so we can keep this technological innovation going. There's an article with a headline is "Developer Says China's in a Slump." And then in that article, he has circled, "The company said the Chinese government is faced with an increasingly complex, grim, and uncertain development environment." Boy, is that corporate lingo or what? "As it implements pandemic control measures and tries to stabilize the economy." His question is, does the Chinese government and private banks, do they have the same or similar options that U.S. banks have to control their economy? Man, ask a question, a simple question, get a complicated answer. Here we go. China has more tools at its governmental leisure disposal to control aspects of the government of the economy than the United States does. They are mostly on the control too much growth rather than stimulate the economy. They can stimulate the economy. So let's kind of take a step back. They're going through a world of hurt right now. Let me kind of lay out where these world of hurt issues come from. Number one, during the global financial crisis, when the United States dealt with massive amounts of bad debt, bad real estate debt, Europe did too. Basically, the entire developed world dealt with this huge amount of way over leveraged positions. People buying three houses when they needed one house so that they could sell two of them to someone else so that they could, those other people could have five houses so that they could sell four of those to someone else so somebody else could have 12 houses and so on. There's an end to that at some point. We produce too many houses, we produce too much debt. And when people couldn't pay the debt because we ran out of people to buy these extra houses, nobody knew whose debt was owned by whom and who owed what. So this is a nightmare. We those of us that lived through it, those of you that didn't live through it, go read about it because it's important. China didn't go through that. Instead, during that same time period, it increased the amount of money that it was loaning to real estate developers. I mean, that sounds like what we did that led up to the global financial crisis. What we did in the United States to fix that is there were a bunch of laws passed that said, hey, you can't, if you're a bank, there's a limit on what you can loan out. There's a limit on how we trade these loans after the effect. We put a bunch of restrictions in place. China has, since the global financial crisis, continued to ramp up its borrowing on real estate development. During the global financial crisis, when the rest of us were having this what we called the Great Recession, though those of us that went through it didn't think it was that great. Somebody named it that, and I don't know who it was. That was not a great name. I think they meant the big one, but instead they used the great one. So we had a Great Recession. We dealt with our debt on our end. They built ghost towns in China. The government owns the banks in China. So your question about does Chinese government and private banks have the same or similar options? One of the things that Chinese government has been cracking down on in the last 2 years when we talk about them stamping out innovation is any company that looks like it might be a private bank has been squashed or taken over by the state. When you think about, you know, ride sharing, we have a whole series of companies, you can Uber it, or there's tons of ride-sharing companies. They accept money from your credit cards. Well, they didn't have that system in China. So they became private banks, and there are a series of ride-sharing companies there. The Chinese government has come in and said, no, we are the bank, and has really squeezed these companies. So in many ways, they have more control over the banking issues than we do. However, if they go and collect, they don't have a foreclosure system that works well. They really don't have a bankruptcy system. So how do you resolve debts when 100% of the debt is due to 100% of the people that loaned it to you if you don't have the money? How do you resolve who gets the assets? Well, the local bureaucrats in China decide that, and they take a chunk of it themselves. So while they have more tools to influence the economy, the tools are all based in some things that, well, they have some very lacking tools when it comes to innovation. I'll put that as extremely as I can. When we stimulate the economy in the United States, when we lower interest rates, private companies get loans, private citizens get loans, and they spend that money according to their own desires. When a private corporation spends that money, it's generally with the intent of getting more earnings, more profits for the future. That's not necessarily how loans work in China. Much of the loans that are in China right now are to people and entities that are not profitable. A lot of these real estate development firms are just absolutely not profitable. It's the opposite. They're losing money hand over fist, and they're making up for it by getting more loans from the state. Well, the state has said, we're not doing that anymore. So they have this massive debt crisis right in the middle of massive government lockdowns. So while the government of China has the ability to open up the floodgates of money and allow people to continue to build and grow, it's reverse to the concept of locking down huge chunks of their population not able to work because of COVID. Do they have the tools? Some of them. More of the some of them than we do. They're just lacking the non-governmental tools, the non-banking tools of innovation and the ability to keep what you make. If you invent a product in China and you get a loan to sell that product, to manufacture and sell that product, it is much more likely that in the process of doing this, your secret's going to be linked to all your competitors, and they're all going to spend you into oblivion, and you won't get to benefit from your invention. Which is why when we look at new innovations that come out of the world, even though China is by far larger than the United States, they come in with less than a quarter of our patents on the international level. They just do not have, and that's not growing. Where you see other aspects of the Chinese, you know, revolution in industry and economics, where they're booming economy, they've been taking over big chunks of the world stage. When it comes to their patents, it's not been growing. Their innovation has been stagnant through this, and that's a major factor that we throw in here. So yes, they have a lot of tools, but the tool that they're missing is, how do you stimulate innovation? How do you get people that invent things to keep the value of what they invent so that they continue to invent more things? This is another thing that is quite important to realize. On the patent rolls, it's a very small minority of patents are issued to people that have never created patents before. That means people that invent tend to invent a lot more than just one thing. They tend to invent a lot of things. And if the first thing they invent is stolen from them, they're very unlikely to continue to try to sell their inventions. So that is a major twist. During our downturn in the pandemic, innovation exploded in the United States. It did not in China. It has not in China, and is still not in China. And you're pregnant with some thoughts, so please give birth on this.
I'm actually ready to go into the next question.
All right, excellent. All right. I'll read it out, and you can answer it. What do you think?
Whatever.
All right. Inquisitor John again. He says, what does the personal wealth coach think? Is GDP or GDI a more accurate reflection of the U.S. economy? What do you think?
Well, for starters, the headline of the article that he sent was the economy might just be stagnating, which I think is interesting because on the digital version of the Wall Street Journal, which is what we read, it says the same article, headline, a different take on the U.S. economy. Maybe it isn't really shrinking. Two different approaches to this. The gross, we talked about this last week at some length, actually. The gross domestic income in the United States is very different from the gross domestic product of the United States. They ought to be, typically, under normal, and I said we're not in normal circumstances. In normal circumstances, they tend to be pretty much the same thing, but they're not right now. And we think, I am of the opinion, and I'm certainly, this is just my opinion, gross domestic income is probably more accurate than gross domestic product. Gross domestic product has some things thrown in there that we consider fundamentally inaccurate, which is the import-export issue.
Can I what are the variables in these things? Sure. We have a lot of nerds that listen to us because they like our nerdliness. Gross domestic products equation is you add up consumption, investment, government purchases and exports, then you subtract imports. All of that is inflation adjusted. Gross domestic income is you add up wages, profits, interest income, rental income, and taxes. Then you subtract production and import subsidies. So where the government is giving back money in taxes for imports. And then there's some statistical adjustments. Both of them have statistical adjustments. So both of them are inflation adjusted. Gross domestic income is really looking at what is the income to all of these major entities, to corporations, to individuals. And gross domestic product is looking at what we're spending. So there's a, yeah, go ahead.
Keeping it simple, let's bring it down to a bumper sticker. One of my favorite bumper stickers that I've ever seen. It said happiness is a positive cash flow. So gross domestic income is how is the cash flow doing in the United States? And gross domestic, the GDI says the cash flow is doing just fine.
Yeah.
We're economy, we're growing, we're increasing our cash flow at about 1.4% a year right now.
That's inflation adjusted. So that's true growth.
Mm-hmm. And GDP for the first two quarters says, no, the economy's shrinking. It's kind of like in a business, we have a business. We've had a business for decades.
Not four decades, but four decades.
Actually, four decades I've had a business.
We've had a business four decades. Four decades.
Yes. Yes. We've had a four decade business for anyway.
For decades, we've had a four decades business. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
The bottom line to it is I don't dig deep into the financial statements and try to figure out all kinds of things like depreciation and appreciation and what would the building sell for if I had to sell the building. Shoot, if I had to sell the building that we're in, then we wouldn't have a business. So I'm not even going to pay any attention to that.
Yeah.
That would be like considering gross domestic product. I looked at the bottom line. How much cash do we have on hand now versus a year ago? If we have more, we obviously had net income. After tax, net income. And we didn't spend it on anything, so we now have a bigger savings account than we had a year ago. I equate that with good. If we're charging along and all the numbers did which and what and they went this way and that way, but we wound up at 1 year later with less cash and we hadn't purchased anything major, we might want to consider what's going on here. Yeah. And that's the way I look at the United States economy. Gross domestic income is, if you look at how much money adjusted, if you can adjust for inflation, if you track your personal inflation, how much money you're making now, if you're in business and you're productive, and how much money you were making a year ago and 10 years ago, 5 years ago and 10 years ago. And if you are actually, and I don't mean retired people, but if you're in business and you're making more money after adjusting for inflation now than you were in the past, you're growing. And that's GDI. And I think that's the best way to measure the economy.
Yeah. And basically, if you think of the two as you're taking a temperature on the economic body in different places with the same thermometer. It's not really the same thermometer. Just go with me. You just need to be consistent on where you're taking that temperature and understand what it means, because it means something different. If you just got out of a shower and it was a hot shower and you're taking your temperature from your forehead, it's going to be hot. If you take it from inside the mouth, it might be hot, but not as hot. If you take it from the bottom of the foot, it's going to be different. And with GDP, we're trying to measure activity. With GDI, we're trying to measure activity. But you need to watch what the activity is. They're both really good representations of the economy as long as you understand their weaknesses and follow along and understand when the GDP is shrinking for 6 months of a year, how can we not be in a recession? Well, the GDI, everybody's making more money, even adjusted for inflation, even though our consumption and our the parts that make up investment and government purchases and exports minus imports is down.
Consumption's up.
Consumption's up. When you add it all together, consumption, investment, government purchases, and exports minus imports, it's down. But when you look at wages, profits, interest income, rental income, taxes, it's up. So from pure cash flow perspective, we're not in a recession. People are being paid more than they were, in many cases, even more than inflation adjusted what they were.
And they're spending more than they were, even adjusted for inflation. And right. They're buying more things than they were. So it really comes down, and that leads, that's a good segue into what it was released this week in the economy that's important.
Well, let me add one massive piece that will actually hopefully clear up that mumbo jumbo. One major chunk of GDP is government purchases. That doesn't just mean what they buy. Could mean what they buy. It means government spending. And a bunch of that government purchases, so put some air quotes around that, we're in a bunch of grants that were given that were forgiven. So it looks like we had the reverse of government purchases. All those PPP loans that were given back, all that forgiven debt causes GDP to drop. Even though the people that received that money got an income increase and they're buying more stuff with it, the government side is a negative. Where when you look at the gross domestic income, tax revenue is massively up for this year. So even on the government side, we have a major positive. Okay, those were the last two pieces that needed to be in that puzzle. Now back to you for your segue.
Well, even the article that John sent, which was entitled differently on in the digital version, says he has a quote here from a professor. The economy is stagnating, but it's not declining. Well, stagnating sounds pretty bad. He's a Northwestern University professor named Robert Gordon. Here's the reality. The Labor Department on Friday released its monthly employment situation summary. And yes, unemployment jumped from 3.5% to 3.7%, but nobody lost their jobs. I mean, people did lose their jobs, but we net created in the month in the United States 315,000 new jobs and filled them.
Let me real quick add definition for stagnate. If water or air ceases to flow or move, or to cease developing, become inactive or dull. We're not seeing that. There's no lack of activity. Nothing is dull right now.
In the economy, we're creating easily, right now, in the month of August, created twice as many jobs as we'd have if we were stagnating. The reason the unemployment rate jumped from 3.5 to 3.7 is because a bunch of people joined the labor force. Now, some of those people were just joining the labor force for the first time, but the majority of them, and it was 0.3% of the labor force, we had a 0.3% increase, which doesn't sound like much, but you look at 3.5 to 3.7, that's 0.2%, which means about for every three people who joined the labor force who weren't in it before in the month of August, two of them found a job. And that's the way it's going. Or one of them found a job and the other two just came into the labor force and they haven't. And it's not that they can't find a job. Goodness gracious. We still have far more job openings than we have people looking for jobs. They're being really picky. That's why they stayed out so long. They're really being picky about which job they take. That is not a stagnating, shrinking or economy that's slipping into recession. Another aspect of that that's very important is to recognize that employers don't hire large quantities of new people if they believe a recession is coming in the next year. It usually takes about a year for an employee to become highly productive, minimum. some places, I guess, flipping hamburgers at McDonald's or something at the very low end of the spectrum, they can become productive in a month or two. But employers tend to hire for the long term because it's very expensive to hire somebody. You have to have somebody training them, which means you become less productive, which, by the way, is why the productivity numbers have dropped. We've talked about that. The productivity numbers dropped in the second quarter. They're probably dropping right now. When we're hiring a lot of people, when the economy is growing quickly, productivity numbers drop because you have to take your most productive people and put them to training people who are zero productive. They're on the payroll, but they're not doing anything effective yet. They're costing money, but not creating product yet because they're still being trained. And you have to take your best, most productive people and use them to train the people who aren't being productive at all. So I've seen many articles go by, says, oh, this is terrible. Productivity is falling. We're sliding into stagflation. Baloney. There is no evidence of stagflation. I've been through stagflation.
Has a definition. It's when you have high inflation and high unemployment. We have the opposite of high unemployment.
So there's a lot of people wanting to be very afraid. And frankly, there's a political leaning to it. Matter of fact, if you read publications that lean to the left and lean to the right or in the middle, you get a different view of what's going on in the economy. The further the publication leans to the right, the more negative it is about the economy. Why? Well, the Democratic Party controls the House and the Senate and the White House right now, and they don't like that. Therefore, the economy is going to be reported as being bad.
Yeah, it's
going
to be. You can flip this around. The left-wing side of the media was much more negative about the economy when the Republicans
certainly
had the entirety of the government. This is just something you can expect. Just expect that when you're reading your media or listening to your media or watching your media, know what their intent is, filter it through that intention, and recognize that there's going to be a lot of people being afraid on Fox News right now. These are the same people that were telling you to be enthusiastic in a different political setting. So
and
politics is influencing the news, definitely.
We follow the Wall Street Journal, and I think they have some generally quite balanced news. Bloomberg and some other places, but the Wall Street Journal leans to the right.
We also look at things like the Economist and Financial Times, which are British publications, which give us a really completely weird look at the U.S. economy, but it's effective. Okay, go back to you.
The fact is that for instance, the article that John sent us, The Outlook, by Hilson Rath, is really semi-editorial, and it's important to pay attention to that if you're actually wanting to know what's going on. It's important to recognize that the direct reporting of news, for example, from the Wall Street Journal tends to be extremely accurate. But as soon as we get into opinion, and the economy might just be stagnating, is opinion. You start in the Wall Street Journal to drift to the right. New York Times, you can depend on the fact that if it's even vaguely opinion, they're going to be on the left. And to really know what's going on, it's important to figure a way to go down the middle. Bloomberg, pretty well balanced, but slightly to the left. And I know that most people don't have enough time to do that, which is why we get paid, among other things. It's because we make the time to do this. Reading across the spectrum and carefully distilling out the facts becomes very, very important. So the labor numbers across the board are saying the economy is booming. Job openings continue to rise in July. Employers are begging for workers. Then the Conference Board came out this week. It was a private organization, and they tend to be right down the middle. I've never seen anything that suggests political bias with them. U.S. consumer confidence, they reported, reversed course in August. Now, it hit a four-month low in July, which scared a lot of people. And on their index, it's 139.7 in July, and it rose to 145.4 in August. Well, that is geeky as you can get. But what we've seen is across the board, the stock market, consumer confidence hit bottom in June, mid-June into July, started coming back, and frankly, is continuing to come back. Now, as I said, the stock market has sagged a little bit. It sagged about halfway back to where to the bottom it was in June. But we also, but let's look a little further down the road, and I'll be a little more geeky right here. We got a break for commercials. You want me to geek on the other side of commercials?
Yeah, let's come on the other side of commercials and okay. Talk about that.
I got some more geeky stuff to talk about.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the email addresses in here are Jake or Jeff at tpwc.com. We've got some commercials to play, and we've got a lot more to talk about on the other end. So we'll be back on the other end of these vitally important commercials. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
And we are here to talk more about the economy. We can actually get into personal finance later as well. But we are talking right now. You had something you were going to geek out about. So please get, yeah, and I want to tell folks that we didn't mean geeking literally in the sense of the sword swallowing profession.
That's geeking.
That is what geeking is. To being able to swallow things is to geek it. That's not what we're doing. We're meaning geek in the term of nerdliness.
The fact that you know the accurate and complete perfect dictionary definition of geek tells me that you are one.
Yes, and the second definition, not the first.
Okay. Anyway, we focus a lot on purchasing manager index readings. Why? In companies, manufacturing companies, any company that has a long-term lead time on doing things, which are the ones that are the consistent core companies in the United States, the people who are their customers give them advance warning when they're going to make big orders. They tell them in about 3 months or in about 6 months, I'm going to order a whole bunch of this. I want you to make it for me at that point. I'm willing to contract with you now. Let's get rolling on it. The first people that get involved where we can see what's going on are the purchasing managers. Because for this company to make something, including the restaurant where you go to eat, in order for them to make the food for you to eat, well in advance, they have to do two things. They have to have employees who are capable of fixing and serving the food. And they have to have the food available and the spices and all the stuff they need to make the meal for you. And they need to order that in advance because it doesn't mysteriously appear. They can't run down to the grocery store and get it. Now, some small restaurants literally do that, run down to the grocery store and get it. But it's not very cost effective because it's far more cost effective to order it far upstream and order a big order of the stuff. So the purchasing managers handle that. So two different companies monitor purchase managers in the United States. And they send out a survey, and the purchase managers respond to the survey, and they compile all the stuff together, including the comments of the purchasing managers. And what we see then is where the consensus is for businesses, profitable businesses in the United States, 3 to 6 months from now. And as long as the PMI numbers are above 50, then the purchasing managers are seeing a growth in their business over the next 3 to 6 months. Now, can something happen and that be wrong? Yeah, but consistently, that is the most accurate forecast of business conditions 3 to 6 months from now. And the PMI for both companies, ISI, I've got them mixed up now. Anyway, the two
purchasing
companies.
Purchasing Managing Index, yeah.
They're two different purchasing managing index indices. And the two purchasing manager indices, both are positive right now. Both of them are saying manufacturing and services in the United States are growing. Manufacturing is the one I always look at first. It's continuing to expand. And it is continuing to expand. Now, in both cases, they are saying something very, very clear. It's no longer at 56 or 57. It's down in the low 50s. Why is that important? Anything above 55 in the purchasing managers index is not sustainable. You just, the business is increasing fast enough that the businesses are not going to be able to keep up with it. If it drops down to about 52, 53, that is a sustainable long-term growth rate. And that's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing the purchasing managers across the board saying a couple of things that are very important. Yes.
I have some other things to add in that are good news. So go ahead with yours. I was just letting you know.
They're seeing the orders hold up. They're seeing deliveries do good. Their actual production is running a little bit slow right now. And you could say, oh, well, that's bad. Production's running about the same as it was last month. Why? Well, it's the same old story. They're hiring a bunch of new people. And they're taking their most productive workers to train the new people, which means their production is essentially flat from July to August. There's also, this is the summer, they take vacations. There tends to be flat production. However, the new orders, the backlog, and the deliveries are up significantly. I know this is really geeky, but this is why, and we've been accused of being unduly optimistic. This is why when I see those numbers, I say the economy is growing, and for the next going down the road out to a year, it looks like it's probably going to grow. Why? Because the people who are betting their lives and incomes and companies on it are saying it's probably going to grow into the next year. Now, at the governmental Department of Labor and Commerce level, they may see numbers that are weird and think weird things are going on. And we're almost out of hour, and you had something to say.
Yeah. The first thing I wanted to say is that recently we're being accused of being overly optimistic. But I would like to invite people to go back and listen to some radio programs or read some newsletters from 2019 and 2018 when people were saying we were being overly pessimistic. And if you go back to you can go all the way back here, prior to the global financial crisis, when people were saying we were being overly pessimistic, and then at the bottom, we were being overly optimistic. I'm not saying we're right all the time. What I am saying is that when we see activity that the popular groups are saying isn't happening, and it is happening, we point at it. We say, wait a minute, all the media is talking about that stuff over there. It sells advertisements to talk about recession. We talk about where we are unemployment. So an area we've talked about demographically, and I'm going to say this really fast, hospitality and leisure as an area of employment had the biggest hit during the COVID era. We are well above by a significant majority, a significant number, where we were prior to pandemic. We were at about 20.5 million, according to ADP, employed before, and now we're at like 21.3 million employed. That's a major influx. We're seeing that in all kinds of areas, and we're almost out of time. So we're going to talk more about this next hour. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, those same email addresses work, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com, or you can email or you can call us locally at
254-947-1111.
Or toll free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com for podcasts, email, contact form, all that good stuff. We've got newsletters going back a long time on the webpage. It's worth going back there to look to see when we were overly optimistic and when we were overly pessimistic for real. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. Thank you very much for listening, presuming you did.